You're listening to the However Improbable podcast, a Sherlock Holmes book club that narrates and discusses Arthur Conan Doyle's classic tales. We're reading them in the order they occurred in the lives of the great detective and his good doctor.
Holmes himself famously said that there's nothing new under the sun, but we're willing to give him a run for his money. I'm Sarah Cole.
And I'm Marissa Mercurio. This week, we have a tale of two families, a left-handed killer, and a highway robbery. It's the Boscombe Valley mystery.
It truly is like a blank space in my memory of the canon.
Me too.
We will get into it.
We'll get into it.
The Boscombe Valley mystery was published in The Strand in 1891. It's featured in the short story collection, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. So it's an early one. Published a year later with 10 Sidney Paget illustrations. Fun fact, Paget's drawing for this story is the first depiction of Holmes with his famous deerstalker hat on, which he never specifically wears in the canon.
I did notice the illustrations because I read the illustrated Sherlock Holmes for these, and I clocked that deerstalker cap.
Is the cause of the deerstalker cap. I was actually at the Sherlock Holmes Museum in October in London, and they made this big point of pointing out, well, he probably would have just worn a top hat or a little bowler hat like other Victorian gentlemen.
I love that weird little place. What a weird museum.
So strange. That's a whole other can of worms. But But so people are fighting back against the deerstalker, and this is where it came from. Baring Gould puts the story over a long weekend in June 8th to 9th, 1889, to be exact. To listen to our audio adaptation of the story, go back an episode. We will be here.
All right. First up, a summary. The case begins when Watson, who is at home with his wife, Mary, gets a telegraph from Holmes asking for help on a case. The two of them travel to a place called Boscombe Valley to investigate the murder of a man named Charles McCarthy, who was bludgeoned to death in the woods near his home. Charles and his son James lived on the land of a wealthy landowner named John Turner, who has a daughter named Alice. James had followed his father into the woods, and everyone assumes he killed him. Alice isn't so sure, and wrote to Inspector Lestrade, who called on Holmes.
Throughout his investigation and a series of deductions, Holmes determines the murder was committed by a left-handed man with a limp who smokes cigars. There's a really good sort of deductive, you know, classic Holmes moment of trotting out these facts in front of people. They also discover that Charles wanted his son and Alice to get married, but James had gotten hitched to a barmaid in a youthful indiscretion and couldn't. Finally, John Turner comes clean and confesses to murdering Charles and tells a tale of his youthful life of crime.
John had been a member of a gang of bushrangers in Australia called the Ballarat Gang. They had robbed a gold convoy, and John spared the life of the wagon driver, Charles, even though he knew Charles could identify him in the future. The robbers took the gold and left Australia, and John resolved to change and split ways with the gang.
And years later, Charles tracked John down in England and strong-armed him into living on his land for free. I think John gave him a farm or something to avoid getting blackmailed. Charles eventually demanded the marriage of James and Alice, and John killed Charles to stop his daughter marrying someone with, and this is his words, cursed blood. John signs the confession, and Holmes agrees to keep it secret until it's needed to acquit James of the murder. Eventually, James goes free, John dies of some illness or old age, and the son and daughter marry without any knowledge of the crimes of their fathers.
Weird one. It's a weird
super
one.
Super weird story. I had a hard time really parsing how it ended and what happened and how the kid got out of jail and why they got married. I don't know.
Yeah, so that the end, I know we're jumping in the gun here, but let's just talk about the end because I think the things that we're interested in are not the plot of the story of the mystery as much as some other details. But the end is very strange. So essentially, Turner comes to Holmes saying, I got your letter. I know you know. I killed McCarthy. He unveils his whole sordid history with the man, reveals that he's essentially been blackmailed into giving this land for free. And he says, I have diabetes. I'm going to die within a month, even though it ends up being like seven months.
Yeah, like much longer than this.
Yeah. And he's like, can you please just like figure out a way so that the boy James can get off without implicating me, because it would, break my daughter's heart either way, whether James did it or whether I did it. and, you know, to protect her from all this information about his own history. And then it becomes supremely unclear how Holmes, in fact, gets James off without providing any evidence.
I know.
Because Turner writes a letter saying, I did this. And Holmes is like, we'll only pull this out if it comes to it, you know, if we have to. But it doesn't seem that Holmes had to do that. And I don't really understand how he gets away with it.
Watson is very vague about something about just, like, the other deductions that Holmes made are enough evidence to at least acquit James. And I guess they just don't arrest anybody for this murder. I also, this is not related, but I had a really hard time. There's a Charles and a John and a James, and I had a hard time keeping them all straight. There's a lot of, like, very biblical male names in the story.
Yeah.
And I was, particularly John and James, I'm like, I don't know which one you're talking about. Well, but neither does Arthur Conan Doyle, because he, you know, gets Watson's name wrong. So maybe Doyle and I are the same here. Anyway.
The other detail that I thought was strange about the end is that Alice and James
get married.
Seem to be getting married at the end, even though Alice is like, I only like him as a brother.
Yeah. And
so
there's also this weird plot where James is trying to tell his father, who doesn't want to tell his father that he gotten married when he was, like, in college to a barmaid.
Gotten
but then the
marriage
wasn't legal, so it actually wasn't a thing. So I don't even know why they brought that up at all.
It's kind of a sloppy one,
yeah,
to be honest. There's a couple really great moments, but the plot itself is not Conan Doyle's best.
And I feel, I mean, it's an early story, so I think, you know, his writing it kind of improves, and he does similar stories like this. It really made me think of the Five Orange Pips. It also made me think of sort of like the backstory in The Sign of Four, where the relations of men who had committed crimes previously and run away from them are then kind of dealing with the fallout later on. So all that's to say that Doyle does this a ton in the canon. There are lots of stories like this, and I think that's part of the reason why I had no memory of this one specifically. It's just, like, an Australian-flavored version, but
this theme comes up
pretty often, and I don't think it's doing it particularly well, so I kind of was like, I don't even know. Like, Boscombe Valley? No idea.
Yeah, we can get into it a little bit with Australia, but let's maybe first talk about some of the more fun things, like Watson getting
married. this big reveal. You asked in our last episode when we think Watson and Mary actually get hitched, and we didn't think this had happened in the Copper Beaches, because it kind of just opens on Holmes and Watson sitting in their house and Mary's never mentioned. But Watson and Mary are definitely married and living together as of June 1889.
Yes, and it's also clear that Watson's medical practice is fully up and running again. Seems busy.
Yeah,
he's getting a lot of clients, patients.
I actually really like the opening scene where, like, Watson and Mary are in their house that they've moved into together, and Holmes sends Watson a telegram being like, hey, I really need your assistance, come help. And Mary kind of talks him into it, where Watson's trying to be like, well, I'm just really busy. And Mary goes, I think the change would do you good, and you're always so interested in Mr. Sherlock Holmes' cases. So she's, like, supportive of him tromping around.
It's nice.
Like, go get out of the house and do your hobby, honey.
Right. I do like that moment. And I think there's also a moment where Watson's like, oh, well, it's done me good in the past, referring to meeting Mary.
I should be ungrateful if I were not seeing what I gained through one of them. So,
right.
He's a sap.
It's sweet.
Yeah. Yeah, so.
There is a moment, too, that I thought was interesting about just in terms of how long they've been married. A sentence that gave me pause, which Watson says that he has not seen a newspaper in several days.
Oh, huh.
And I couldn't quite understand what that was referring to. If that was, like, a sort of, like, oh, honeymoon period, or is he just really busy with work?
Yeah.
Is he, like, totally clocked out, like he was having his big life with Holmes, or he was, like, paying attention to the newspapers and the daily goings-on in London, but now is sort of preoccupied with other things?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like he is, I mean, this is sort of the theme of, right, The Sign of Four, is Watson making this decision between his kind of bachelor life with Holmes that's very unconventional and settling into domesticity, which he chooses to do, and he's kind of leaning into that. Like, he's focusing on his job and his business. He has some kind of like, assistant or other doctor that he works with. He's not really paying attention to the news or to crime that's going on. Yeah, I also noticed that, too. And I think my impression was that he's busy and he's just not tapped into the stuff that he was paying lots of attention to when he was living in Baker Street. Also because Holmes would always be like, read the paper to me, tell me what's going on. And he's not doing that anymore.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and it makes you wonder how long it's been since Holmes and Watson have seen each other as well.
That's a good point. I don't know enough about, you know, like, I think people sometimes hypothesize, like, did they have a wedding? What happened? Like, what did that look like? It was sometime in the spring.
I imagine they had a wedding.
They must have had some kind of wedding.
Even if it was, like, a small wedding.
But, yeah, like, Watson doesn't have that many friends. And Mary has no family.
Some of the guys
Mary is
from,
famously an orphan.
From billiards or whatever.
True. He's, like, gambling pals. And not Lestrade, because he's not nice to Lestrade in this story.
That's so true.
Yeah, so it was funny that we were kind of just wondering that, and here we are. They are officially Mr. and Mrs. Watson
very
for a while.
Very clearly married.
Correct. And Mary even gets a little bit of dialogue. Not much.
Good for her.
But a little bit.
You know, I think it's very obvious that this story was written soon after A Study in Scarlet. There's some references to A Study in Scarlet and to Watson having served in Afghanistan. And I think that, for better or worse, there is a little bit of continuity in the story. It does get muddled a little bit later on when Holmes refers to himself and Watson as middle-aged men. or as middle-aged gentlemen.
They're, like, in their 30s right now.
Yeah. They're, like, I'm like, I guess if you stretch it a little bit, I guess you could maybe consider yourself middle-aged in the 19th century, but...
It's funny.
You know, it's like, oh, you're like 30.
Yeah, like
Holmes, come on.
Like maybe 32 or 33.
Yeah.
Like you're not that old.
I think we could talk a little bit about Holmes and Watson's relationship in the story, because as opposed to the previous story, Holmes is super polite to Watson.
Yes. And you know, I think if you consider the fact that Holmes and Mary. Dear God, none of these characters are coming out of my mouth correctly. Watson and Mary got married, and Holmes is, no, they're not living together anymore. Holmes is really kind of sweet. It's like the sweetest we've seen him be in a while.
Yes.
So I'm kind of getting that he's missing his buddy.
Yeah, there's a couple of really nice moments.
Yes. So the right off the bat, the letter that Holmes sends to Watson to get him to come out to help on the case is that he says, "Shall be glad if you will come with me. Air and scenery, perfect." Which I also think is kind of, he's like, I know that Watson likes a walk outside and he likes to look at country houses, so he'll want to come hang out
a little
with
holiday
me.
In the country, right?
Yeah.
And then there's also another moment that, speaking of Richie Holmes, is a line that they borrow in the movie, where Holmes thanks Watson for coming with him, and he says, "It makes a considerable difference to me having someone with me on whom I can thoroughly rely."
Oh, that's such a good
line. And I think in Richie Holmes it's treated as, like, almost kind of jokey sometimes, but I think in this one it's, like, it's very sincere.
Yeah, well, Holmes is very sincere and very kind of straightforward about, you know, he's, like, thankful that Watson is spending time with him. There's also this other little bit in kind of one of those classic moments. I think they're in the inn they're staying in, and he's expounding his ideas, and he asks Watson to, like, sit down and listen to him. And so he says, "Just sit down in this chair and let me preach to you for a little. I don't know quite what to do, and I should value your advice. Light a cigar and let me expound." Where he's kind of acknowledging,
it's a really,
like,
good
that's
line.
What you're, that's our dynamic. Mm-hmm. I kind of spit ideas at you, and you nod and react and maybe get things wrong. But he, like, specifically asks, which I think is very touching.
It is. And there's one more moment I wanted to mention that I pulled that speaks to how well they know each other, and also a little bit of Holmes ribbing Watson, even though he's being very sweet otherwise. Where...
Oh, this is funny.
Holmes explaining, you know, how he's deduced this little detail. And Holmes says to Watson, "My dear fellow, I know the military neatness which characterizes which characterizes you. You shave every morning, and in this season, you shave by the sunlight. But since your shaving is less and less complete as we get further on the back of the left side, until it becomes positively slovenly as we get around the angle of the jaw, it is surely very clear that the side is less well illuminated than the other. I could not imagine a man of your habits looking at himself in an equal light and being satisfied with his with such a result. Which... I don't think he's trying to be rude here at all to say, like, your beard looks bad, but your shaving is it's a bad job, but it does speak at least to how well Holmes knows Watson and how much he's picked up on his habits over the course of living with him for so many years.
Yeah, I really like this moment. I also like what it tells us about Watson, that he has not lost his sort of military habits, and that he's usually very neat and tidy and kind of pulled together. Holmes is doing a lot of, or maybe he's, I think he always is like a close observer of everybody, including Watson, who, you know, he had lots of time to observe closely because they were living together, but he shows his hand in a couple moments, and this is one, and this thing about looking at his, like, pattern of his feet is another. He does this a couple times, and I think it's kind of funny.
Let's see, what else did I have here about...
One other little detail, talking about Holmes and Watson, that I like, is that Watson reads a yellow-backed novel.
That is a good moment.
At one point when he's killing time, and he's dissatisfied by it because the actual mystery going on is so much more interesting and engaging, and he can't stop thinking about it, so he, like, puts down this kind of seedy mystery novel he's reading to think about the plot of what's actually happening around him.
There's a great Paget illustration going along with that, where he's, like, laying out on the sofa.
Tossing his book aside, yeah.
One final moment I will highlight is, I think, around that time when Watson is reading, and he's, like, thinking about the mystery and what's going on, he's waiting for Holmes to return, he says, "I had so much faith in Sherlock Holmes's insight that I could not lose hope," which I thought was a really sweet moment. I was like, oh, they're getting along.
Yeah.
How nice.
Yeah, whatever... It's interesting that, like, maybe they're both really trying to play nice, or they've just, like, patched up whatever tension that was really going down in the sign of four when they were very unpleasant to each other, which, you know, not that much time has gone by, all things considered, and they seem to be very intentional about letting each other know how much they appreciate each other in this story. Or maybe they're just really happy to see each other.
Yeah, it's been a minute, maybe, you know? Should we move on to talking a little bit about Australia and just sort of a theme that we've seen in the past?
Yeah, let's, I guess, unpack the trappings of the plot as much as we can, knowing that it's kind of messy and loose.
Yes.
So, Australia, and again, it's this theme where John Turner is suffering ill health because he lived overseas, committed crime. He was like a highway robber, essentially, with a gang of people. Came into a bunch of money because they robbed this carriage, came back to London, and tried to put that all behind him and kind of become a civil citizen and raise a child and own land and all of that stuff. And then, obviously, his past catches up to him. So we've seen this a lot in a lot of stories ways.
A ton, where someone goes abroad, is affected by living abroad, returns to England, and essentially the narrative is blaming whatever crimes have been committed on the fact that this person was abroad and was, like, infected.
And I couldn't tell if the two fathers, like, were born and raised in Australia or if they had traveled there and then could come back. It doesn't really matter because it's really, like, it's a British colony, and they are white British men, but...
think we have a clear answer, but I do get the sense at least one of them, where they had, like, maybe Turner especially was born in England, gone to Australia, and then returned. But yeah, I think the penal colony of it all is incredibly important, because if Australia in the Victorian imagination is already being framed as this place of crime, then of course the two characters' history is going to be riddled with crime. And then bringing that back to England is going to just reinfect England with the crime that was happening in Australia, or, you know, perhaps McCarthy had been there as a prisoner and escaped or something. But either way, I think, you know, figuring Australia as this place of crime and then having those folks return to England speaks volumes to how people in the 19th century were conceiving of Australia and settler Australians.
Right. Yeah, and I was really a little hung up on which of the two of them is meant to be sympathetic to the readers in the story, and because Charles McCarthy is not.
Right, and yes, definitely.
Very obviously, but he also was, like, in the events that happened in the past, he was driving the wagon that got attacked and jumped by this gang, and they chose not to kill him, and then he, you know, leveraged that to get a leg up in the world later on, which...
Mm-hmm.
Just, like, the way that this is being weighted and the way that John Turner's narrative unfolds is really odd, because he's like, oh, yeah, I, like, totally robbed this guy, but then he was blackmailing me.
Yeah, I think, like, the sympathy that we get from him.
Both of those great things to do.
No, it's totally just the fact that he's a father and he's old.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's basically it, where Holmes is like,
yeah,
no need to ruin these kids' lives.
I guess that's because Holmes is also kind of sympathetic to him. Clearly, he doesn't just, like, trot him off to jail because he has his signed confession. Holmes kind of, like, figures out another way ambiguously to get this wrapped up that nobody goes to jail. Yeah, so I guess, like, I was a little perplexed. I think it's just because it's not particularly well written. It doesn't really do it for me. And maybe if it was better done, you would actually, like, be more on his side. But I kind of was like, okay.
Yeah, the characters are kind of
you still bludgeon this guy to death in the woods. Like, I think you could have done something
else. That's true. Here. Like, he's dying of diabetes, but he's able to bludgeon this man.
Yeah.
In the woods. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. The story doesn't really add up to me.
It doesn't. I think it is, like you said, just not a strong story. I think the characterization is kind of bland, and the mystery itself is kind of obvious.
Yeah.
You know, from the get-go, where they're like, oh, Turner, he's in his bed, sick.
Yeah, and the daughter's like, okay, you cannot, like, speak to him.
How convenient.
Yeah. But he has a limp, and he smokes a pipe,
just,
and he's left-handed.
Not much of a narrative.
No.
But I think it's, you know, interesting insofar as it's another example of this theme that Conan Doyle likes to trot out. Just Australian-themed this time.
Instead of, I guess the sign of four is kind of India. But it's, you know, similar, like, people in jail who come across some money and then return, and then there's a daughter that, you know.
Right, totally.
Something else
it's definitely very similar.
Something I think is a little disappointing is that Alice is almost also, like, a non-character.
Yeah, she's kind of a whole lot of
nothing. She has a couple of lines, and then the son is, like, you never really speak to him, and Holmes goes to interview him in jail, but Watson doesn't come with him.
We don't see,
like,
it. Yeah.
A lot of stuff
Watson's
is kind of happening
reading a book.
Behind the
scenes. Yeah.
Yeah. Watson is more interested in telling us about his book than about, like, the observations happening. So.
It's not, yeah, there's not a lot. The only other thing that I would mention before we move on is the idea of cursed blood, because I think that
this line
tells you a little bit, too, about this idea of, you know, the infection and the Victorians being so obsessed with bloodlines.
Right.
And how that gets passed down, like how crime and degeneration get passed down generationally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like John Turner is so determined that his daughter not marry into this man's bloodline that he kills him, even though the guy he kills is not actually a criminal, as far as we know. Like, he's...
The killer is the criminal.
Yeah. Really, he just, like, put off this murder for, like, 20 years. And if he had just killed him after robbing him in Australia, then he would not have had these problems.
Yeah.
I don't know what kind of moral that is
so
for that story.
Yeah, it's just kind of like a muddled story.
Yeah, it's not my favorite.
No, but it does have one other moment that I want to talk about that I think is interesting, which is... Holmes's deduction process, his little investigation that he has.
Watson uses some very colorful language in here.
Yes, there's a lovely little moment. I'll just read a little passage
right
here that I think is probably the best part of the story. Mm-hmm. And this is when Holmes is doing his investigation around the pool where McCarthy was murdered. Sherlock Holmes was transformed when he was hot upon such a scent as this. Men who had only known the quiet thinker and logician of Baker Street would have failed to recognize him. His face flushed and darkened. His brows were drawn into two hard black lines, while his eyes shone out from beneath them with a steely glitter. His face was bent downward, his shoulders bowed, his lips compressed, and the veins stood out like a whipcord in his long, sinewy neck. His nostrils seemed to dilate with a purely animal lust for the chase, and his mind was so absolutely
I'm sorry, I'm laughing.
And his mind
it's throwing you off.
And his mind was so absolutely concentrated upon this matter before him that a question or remark fell unheeded upon his ears, or at the most only provoked a quick, impatient snarl in reply.
Yeah, this is quite an image.
Great.
Lots of descriptions of Holmes's nostrils.
His animal lust.
It's a really, like, vividly depicted. I think what I wrote, when I also picked out this paragraph, I just wrote that Watson's writing is wild in this story.
It's really good. I mean, yeah. It's ludicrous. I think it maybe speaks to a little bit of what Conan Doyle was trying to do early on, was in A Study in Scarlet, and then in the story, he's like, he's a logician, and he's brilliant, but he's also, you know, a man of action, and really trying to marry those two ideas together. Because I don't feel like, we definitely get this in other stories too, but I feel like Watson is just like pointing it out so much in this passage.
Yes, it's, we get it, Watson. We get it.
Yeah, we get it.
The sinews in his neck are really standing out. Mm-hmm. Understood.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you, Watson.
There's definitely a part in A Study in Scarlet when they're kind of first introduced and they're at the first crime scene that feels very similar to this. And again, this was, you know, this is a pretty early story. I feel like we haven't seen it in a minute. This kind of like watching Holmes transform. We've gotten a lot of Holmes like doing acrobatics and climbing onto roofs and wiggling around on the ground. But like where his face really changes when he's super focused, I think is... It certainly is, like, driving the point home of what you're getting across, that sometimes he's sort of overcome with his passion and his focus in a way that feels a little contrary to him sitting in his armchair and just puzzling over things.
I think we did want to probably talk about Lestrade.
Yeah, this is worth mentioning because we haven't seen him in a minute, and Watson is kind of rude to him in a way that really made me laugh and also made me feel a little bit bad for Lestrade, who is truly, in this case, just trying to do his job. This kind of made sense to me, thinking that this was published not so long after A Study in Scarlet, where Holmes and Lestrade are quite antagonistic, and Lestrade is like kind of disrespects Holmes as Watson's getting to know him, so he's probably holding this grudge and kind of carrying it around. But Watson describes Lestrade as a lean, ferret-like man, furtive and sly-looking.
Hmm.
And then at one point he calls him indifferent and contemptuous.
Damn,
and then Lestrade does have a little moment. He does kind of push back when Holmes is running around on the ground with his nostrils dilated. He says, "I am a practical man, and I really cannot undertake to go about the country looking for a left-handed gentleman with a game leg. I should become the laughingstock of Scotland Yard." He is not impressed by Holmes's antics. He's kind of like, "Listen, I've got to like actually do my job." This makes me wonder how on earth they convinced him to let this young man out of jail, and I really would like to know those details, but...
It would be helpful.
It's
it does. You get the sense that, again, because Conan Doyle wrote this not too long after A Study in Scarlet, that you're like, oh, remember Lestrade? He's back.
He's that weaselly little guy, and we hate
him. Whereas, like, if you're, you know, reading it in the chronology like we are, we're like, yeah, we know who Lestrade is. Thank you.
Yes. It, literally every time he appears, he's described as looking like some kind of rodent.
It's, like, really rough.
It's just really kind of mean. So, poor Lestrade. He did call Holmes to ask for his help in this case, so you think
Holmes
could be like, Watson, chill, but no, that is not so.
Yeah. And, again, he doesn't really do a lot either.
No, he's kind of just there.
He's present, but doesn't really do anything.
Yeah. Well, neither do Holmes and Watson.
That's true, honestly.
Watson reads a book, and Holmes
Watson
looks
gets
at some mud.
At.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All in a day's work.
So, kind of that's that of the story.
Yeah, I got nothing. If this is your favorite story and you really want to come to its defense, let us know, but I cannot emphasize how little this stuck in my memory to the point where I had listened to a different story and thought that that was the story that we were talking about and then was confused. So it's truly like a non-entity other than the detail that Watson has gotten married, which, you know, is relevant for tracking the plots as trying to put them in order.
Yeah, I have certainly not read this one since I read all of them for the first time in high school.
Yeah, I think it blends in my mind into a lot of similar tales. And on that that vein, it is not widely adapted. Let's talk about adaptions for a minute, or adaptations. And I picked these out. They seem to really have this theme where people adapting this story straight up just replace Lestrade with other detectives. So he's really not well represented in the Boscombe Valley Mystery. So one notable adaptation, the Peter Cushing 1968 movie of this, Lestrade is replaced by a local policeman named Inspector Lanner. The Granada version is 1991. It's got Edward Hardwick in it, so it's a little bit later. Lestrade is replaced by another fake detective called Inspector Summerby.
Summerby's fun. That's a fun name.
And then the most interesting thing I thought was worth mentioning is that in 2007 at the Edinburgh Festival, there was a theatrical adaptation of the story called Murder in the Gardens. The story is moved to take place in Edinburgh, and it's takes place when Holmes and Watson are much younger than they are when this happens. So someone, I guess,
I mean, I would see that.
Was trying to localize this to make it feel a little bit more Scottish. It sounds kind of interesting to me. I didn't track down the script or anything, but I was just in Edinburgh too. So I was kind of like, oh, hey.
Nice.
I went to, I walked past Arthur Conan Doyle's birthplace, which is yet another sculpture of Sherlock Holmes because they're all over the place. But
yet another, certainly.
Yeah, that's kind of it.
I would see that play, though. That sounds fun. I could see where someone could liven up the story.
I think so.
Punch, some character to it.
Something that's ending up on stage. It's fairly self-contained. It's the murder is kind of dramatic. So someone with the desire to punch it up, I think, could make it much better than it is.
Yeah. What about read-alikes? What do you have?
I just wanted to mention one thing, just talking about crime and detectives in Australia, which is, of course, Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, which, if people have not watched this, it's kind of set in the 1920s in Melbourne, I think. But I think the first episode is called Murder on the Ballarat Train, where they're on a train from Melbourne to Ballarat. So that just really came to mind. I assume people who like detective fiction know about the show, but it's just the best. So thought I would throw that out there. If you like Australia and crime committing and Essie Davis in very fun 20s flapper outfits.
I'm glad you leaned into the Australia of it all, because that's also what I did.
Great.
Because I was like, what else can we possibly talk about here? So I went with two things. The first one, I'm like, it's kind of loose. I was essentially just like, what is a good Victorian Australian text? And what I came up with, I did end up coming up with a Victorian Australian text. I also initially came up with Picnic at Hanging Rock, which is set in the Victorian era, I think 1900, so the tail end, but it's a great mystery,
movie's
phenomenal,
great book.
Book's good, highly recommend it. It's not a murder mystery, but it is a mystery. It's in Australia, It's great. It's just good.
Yeah, it's such a good, it's a really good movie. I should rewatch it. It's been a minute.
Yeah, it's so good. So that's Picnic at Hanging Rock by Joan Lindsay. And the other book I wanted to mention was The Mystery of a Hansom Cab by Fergus Hume, which was published in 1886, first in Australia, and then, interestingly, went on to sell over 500,000 copies worldwide, outselling the first Sherlock Holmes novel, A Study in Scarlet.
Well, I've never heard of
Which was published the
Fergus
following
Hume.
Year.
So, sorry, Fergus.
Isn't it funny how things outsell and then you never hear of them later?
Yeah, true.
Or they don't and then they do, you know? Like Moby Dick utterly failing to make any waves when it was published and is now the great American novel.
That is a great American novel. Not related. Moby Dick has nothing to do with the story. It's just
Moby Dick has
genuinely
nothing to do with
such
this,
a good
book. But there probably is an Australian in Moby Dick.
I think there must be, right?
There must be.
Yeah.
Anyways, those are two Australian novels.
We're really reaching for this story.
There's just not a lot in this story. Like, I wish it were richer. I feel like you Conan Doyle could have written a really interesting, could have written a really interesting mystery about Australia and Britain's relationship to Australia, some Australian characters, and he just kind of doesn't.
Or also that theme of, you know, like, children and the sins of their parents, and that, like, that is a rich grounds for a murder mystery, which he does not really explore at all, and none of these characters get fleshed out. And the thing with stuff like this, like, there are a lot of duds in the canon. We haven't really encountered one in a while, but I, like, know that Doyle can do better. Yeah. And I also know that he phones it in a ton, and a lot of times he was just cranking out stories to, like, make money and pay for his mistress or whatever it was he was doing. which is, this is probably what this was, but, like, I know that he can write a better story than this, and yet we're reading it anyway. So there you are.
Although I did like the opening scenes, it does make you wish that Mary's reintroduction to the canon had been with a little bit more fanfare.
I know. We'll have to keep an eye on this as we get going, but I don't know if her presence is, like, this might kind of be the highlight where at least she is sort of physically present and has
some dialogue. Mary.
I'm sorry, Mary.
Yeah.
Poor thing.
I guess we'll see next time.
Yep. Yeah, we'll have to track this. You can send your thoughts up to howeverimprobablepod@gmail.com or reach us on Twitter @improbablepod. Our website, howeverimprobablepodcast.com, has got research behind the episodes, suggestions for further reading, links, all that kind of stuff. If you enjoyed the show and can spare a moment, please rate and review.
However Improbable is created by Marissa Mercurio and Sarah Kolb, with apologies to Arthur Conan Doyle. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, dear listeners, believe us to be very sincerely yours.